Welcome to The Safety Break, the Whitewater Rescue Podcast. We're here to share stories of real river accidents and rescues and find expert advice on how to solve the problems you might encounter in the Whitewater River environment. I'm your host, Jack Diddy, an emergency medicine physician, whitewater paddler, and wilderness medicine educator. Together, I hope we can celebrate successful rescues and learn from our mistakes in a supportive environment. If you have a story to share of a non-fatal accident or rescue, send me an email at thesafetybreak@gmail.com or contact me on our Facebook page, The Safety Break. If you like what you hear, hit the subscribe button and follow us on social media. I hope you learned something valuable in the show. As you might guess from the intro music, this episode takes us to sunny California, where we'll hear a story about a vertical rope rescue from the base of a difficult waterfall and discuss how prolonged cold water immersion can create serious and potentially lethal problems during rescue attempts. In late June of 2023, as an epic winter snowpack was melting out of the Sierra Mountains, the Royal Gorge section of the North Fork of the American River came into good form, and some of the best paddlers in the country converged on this whitewater masterpiece. It's a deep wilderness class 5 run, capped off with 5 tall and consequential waterfalls. The one you may be most familiar with is Scott's Drop, an 85-foot cascading monster first run by Scott Lindgren, and certainly on the upper limits of what's possible in a kayak. On the day of our story, a record number of paddlers completed the Royal Flush, the designation given for running all 5 of these complicated drops in the same day. And Dane Jackson on this day, in peak form, delivered some of the most astounding downriver freestyle moves ever attempted. The most incredible was his line off of Scott's, doing a cobra flip from the lip of the cascade. You should search out the video clip. It's truly amazing. He pulled off some freestyle moves on the other drops as well, including a successful reverse freewheel off of a drop called Heath 2. This waterfall has a bad cave feature complicating the landing, which brings us to this episode of The Safety Break. The story comes today from Eric Amason and one of his rescuers, Ben Coleman. In the last few years, you may have seen some of Eric's YouTube videos featuring the most complex steep rapids in the Southeast. And he's running them in a C1, which makes this especially impressive. He's really pushing the limits of that style of boat in Class 5 Plus Whitewater. And he's got the right background for it. He is a former member of the U.S. National Slalom Team, and then served overseas as a Navy SEAL. He is now back in civilian life and back in the paddling game. Here's his story.
My name is Eric Amason, obviously. I was born and raised in the D.C. area, so Great Falls was kind of my training ground. My dad started me in a canoe. I was probably in the age of 5 or 6, and then moved away from the DC area, getting in more into slalom. And then after a slalom career, basically from around the Athens to Beijing Olympic time period, I then went into the Navy for 9 years and didn't paddle as much during that time. However, I kind of started getting back into it with a 3-year tour in Germany and got on a lot of runs in the Alps there. And then when I got out of the service, I followed my wife's family back to Huntsville and moved to the Southeast and got more into boating as life settled down post-military a little bit more, and have been working in commercial real estate, so have a little bit more flexibility to entertain some more hobbies and getting back into boating.
Behind the scenes of his video clips, Eric puts in a lot of work, maintaining a high level of physical fitness, spending a lot of time scouting the streams at low water prior to his descents, and studying videos of other paddlers running these drops.
In getting into these bigger drops and bigger rapids, it's really not just a show up and evaluate and decide if it's going to go. There's so much more back work behind the scenes. And that said, a lot of these places, they're usually closer to where I live now, and I will visit them several times. I mean, Foster Falls, I'll go out there 4 or 5 different trips, looking at these drops from all these different angles, looking at them when they're dry, looking at them when they have flow, and knowing going out there that I'm not going to run it that day, but I just want to see what it looks like at all of these different conditions. And all of that research is part of what I feel goes into trying to be successful on these big drops. So it's a lot more than just that one day going out there with the camera.
He took a similar approach to the Royal Gorge, with several preliminary scouting hikes at low water, analyzing videos of the different approaches to running each rapid, and then finally finding the opportunity to run it last summer.
I was going out to focus on the Royal Gorge of the North Fork of the American, which I've always been totally enamored with ever since the original photos came out in the old black and white hard copies of the AWA magazine. And I remember looking at this river with all of these huge waterfalls, and it's really just stuck with me since. And again, that's just one of those staple extreme runs that has seemed like it would just be so out of reach in the C1 realm. So to me, that looks like just such a complicated and challenging problem to try to solve and unlock. I think about that a lot.
The Royal Gorge is awesome. I mean, it is just an incredible piece of whitewater. From the put in to the bottom of Wabena is just, it's one of the most spectacular sections of Class 5 kayaking anywhere in the world. Lots of opportunities to go really, really big.
This is Ben Coleman, who ultimately helped orchestrate Eric's rescue, as we'll hear later.
My name is Ben Coleman. I live in Truckee, California, and I've been kayaking for most of my life. I got into it when I was a pretty young kid with my dad, and mostly cut my teeth on the Kern River. And just, it's been a passion of mine my entire life, and I get out as much as I can. I think on the Royal Gorge, I've done somewhere around 30 trips through the Royal Gorge. So I'm super familiar with that area. And, you know, it's kind of a funky thing because you can drive right to the put in and park right next to the river. But pretty much immediately you are out in the middle of nowhere. By the time you're at the first big waterfalls, you're pretty far away from civilization and just the access. You can't really park at the put in. So as soon as your shuttle driver takes off, like you're out in the middle of nowhere, and it's a wilderness experience for sure. When everything goes right, it's incredible. When things go wrong in there, it becomes super serious immediately. Just because, you know, self-rescue and, you know, access back to a vehicle or a hospital is hours away. You know, this summer when we did our trip through there, it was really good. We had a great flow. And I actually wasn't with Eric and his crew. I was with a different crew, and we caught up to them at Heath Springs. So the Heath Springs series is like, you know, the two waterfalls get all the media attention. It's like a 38-foot waterfall into like a, you know, 52-foot waterfall or something like that. But there's a very stout Class 5 rapid above the first waterfall. And then below the second waterfall, there's like a 15-foot drop that's just in a real narrow notch. So it's this big series. If you're in the river and you kayak from the top to the bottom, you can run the whole thing in under a minute for sure. but setting safety and moving around the riverbank is time consuming and pretty strenuous. Like just the, it's really steep there. And if you're going to portage any piece of that, it just takes quite a bit of work to move around.
When we went in on June 20, Tuesday, 2023, and we were a little closer to 1100, which, you know, the reason why we're talking is because of an entrapment in the Heath 2 cave, with some time that I spent there, which for that rapid, the risk meter's going up with the amount of flow that's going into the big cave on the left, when you're getting into higher flows. That's certainly what was on my mind when I was standing above that rapid on that day. And it was a little different from what I was anticipating and a lot of the research I've seen, especially at, you know, lower flow descents. It's very close between Heath 1 and Heath 2, maybe 20 yards apart. Has a pretty dynamic lip, maybe 3/4 of the flow is out, stretching out over this flake of rock on the left side. And there's this tube of water on the right side. But a lot of that flow, still goes into a big cave on the left, which goes very deep underneath the cliff. It's a big room, you know, 40 feet high, 30 feet high, big vertical walls, super deep teacup gorge, which only exits out of about a 3-foot wide slot on the river right, where all the river water eventually continues downstream out of a little, you know, 10 or 15 foot slot waterfall. So that's kind of everything that's going on there at Heath 2. So ran Heath 1 fine, getting into Heath 2. There were a bunch of groups there at the time. So we had, gosh, maybe like 15 people just at Heath 1 and Heath 2 right at that moment. And so there was a lot going on, and I decided to go first and felt okay with it. And dropped into Heath 2, and I went with fading into the right line with right angle, and felt like the line was fine and resurfaced in the cave, and then got pressed up against the cave wall and kind of, I didn't realize that was as much of a hazard, as I anticipated. So when I went up against that wall, there was a boil that then rolled me up underneath the wall, and it kind of locked in my hull, the way some of those undercuts do, where when you start to roll, you can feel your boat is not budging. And then taking big pulls with your paddling underwater was not budging at either. And then even trying to push with my paddle blade off the wall, it was undercut enough that it was very hard to push, to even reach the wall upside down to push off with my blade. And really, after all of those attempts, I was starting to get a little low on air. So I pulled and swam. And then I went back into the cave. And at that point, I was completely reliant on everyone else around me that was up above on shore. And it was just a waiting game at that point, for them to set up safety and do a rescue.
The typical setup that I've seen when people are going to run Heath 2 is to get one person, before anyone goes, is to get one person down on River Right near the bottom of the falls. It's really hard to actually get to river level there, but you can get pretty close. And that person can be of kind of immediate assistance. And then typically the rest of the crew will stay on river left at the top of the waterfall. So if someone does go in the cave and they're out of their kayak, the easiest way to get someone out is to vertically extract them up the river left side. From the point where the where you can stand is actually a little bit higher than the waterfall. So you're maybe 60 feet above the pool below the waterfall at that point. But to have most of your crew there, one person on river right, because from the river left side, you can't see the back of the cave. So having that person on river right can definitely, you know, it just sets up a good communication line between this someone that needs rescue and the crew that's actually going to do the extraction.
As Ben mentions, the only feasible way to pull someone out of here at this water level is a vertical haul rescue and using just the bare minimum equipment that paddlers typically carry with them. In general, this is usually a last resort option because there's so much that can go wrong. Rope breakage, entanglement issues, difficulties with managing the mechanical advantage system, and the problems associated with improvised harnesses can all lead to serious injuries. I recently heard a report of a permanent nerve injury related to pressure from an improvised harness while the victim was hanging from it during a glacial crevasse rescue. And then there's the risk of asphyxiation in chest harnesses that are tied incorrectly. There's been instances of thin throw ropes being cut from fraying on rocks when used in this capacity, and setting up a mechanical advantage system is much more difficult when moving something over a significant distance. It's different than just pulling a boat a few feet off of a rock. But as this rescue shows, in a life or death scenario, sometimes you just have to get the job done with the minimal equipment that you have. It's a high-risk environment that we operate in. If you think you'll be in this type of place, or you might encounter this scenario, consider getting some formal training and practice it in a controlled environment. Let's hear how it went for them.
I don't really have a good feeling for how much time there was, but it was like, you know, a bunch of people ran the first waterfall and then we kind of reconnected with their group. And it was brought to our attention that he was swimming, he was in the cave, and it sounded like Eric had been in the water for quite a long time. The water's freezing, you're like down in this windy, misty cave, and there's nowhere to get out. Like you're in the water floating with your life jacket at that point. And so we definitely like kicked it into gear, you know, thinking that this situation is quite serious. It seemed like a, you know, pretty full on emergency to get him out of there as fast as possible. One of the crew members with me started building an anchor immediately, and we connected two ropes. We didn't have any, I don't think we had, or no, we did. We had one long rope, but we connected another rope to it just in case. And, Eric got the rope kind of around the same time that the anchor was done being built, and we immediately started pulling them up. And you know, like I said, you can't, from where you're pulling and where the anchor is, you can't really see. We had people on river right. We had paddlers down there at the bottom of the waterfall. At that point, you know, there were people in their boats in the water assisting the rescue from that end. And, yeah, you know, somewhere about halfway up of vertically extracting him, where the two ropes were connected together, was going through the anchor. So we had to pause and reset the anchor on the other side of the rope connection.
You know, as the guys were dropping down a line to do a vertical rescue straight up out of this cave, it took a couple of attempts. Actually, the first attempt, I jumped out of the harness because there was so much time spent on the line, and I was just taking the rope and wrapping it under my armpits. Like, that's all the dexterity I had because of the cold water. And so it was really cutting off my circulation, and I spent several more minutes halfway up while I think they were resetting some of the kind of Z drag and pulleys to go the rest of the distance. But I didn't know if the line had been pinched kind of on the edge of the rocks, and there was kind of rough communication with somebody across the other side of the river. And, you know, you're right next to the waterfall. It's extremely loud. So I couldn't tell what was going on. I ended up jumping out of the harness because I was like, look, this might not be solvable, and they're trying to communicate something, and I'm just not getting the message. The water was so cold and I didn't realize I had a little pinhole leak down by my ankle in my dry suit. I think I caught it on some manzanita. This is really sharp, rugged bush out in California that always tears your gear up. And so I had a little pinhole down at my ankles, and that was slowly leaking. I don't think that was helping with my body temperature, obviously. And the Royal Gorge water is super cold. I mean, it's straight snow melt temperatures there. My internal conversation with myself, I was thinking, if I have to get into a third attempt on the harness here, I wouldn't be able to do anything with a carabiner or a rope down in the water if I was down there much longer. So I was telling myself, all right, I may have to try to swim back across this undercut wall to try to get to that upper pocket and find that ledge to try to self-rescue. I think the odds of my making that was going to be really low. So at that point, I was ready for, just not making it out of that situation.
What Eric is describing is a classic example of incapacitation associated with cold water immersion. This is part of the progression to hypothermia and can occur in just a few minutes in even moderately chilly water. It's part of the body's adaptive mechanism to shunt blood away from the extremities and preserve core warmth. But while preserving this core warmth, the extremities lose function. The victim in these cases loses fine motor control and sensation in the hands and feet, and then loss of general coordination and muscle strength. It's involuntary, and you can't really overcome it until you get out of the water and get warm. Even grasping an object like a rope can be difficult or impossible once this sets in. And drowning risk certainly increases as it progresses. The best way to prevent all of this is with a dry suit with good insulating layers underneath, and something like neoprene gloves or mitts for the hands. It might be worth having these stashed away in your PFD pocket for this kind of scenario. The old mantra of dressing for the swim is probably a wise approach when the water feels even a little bit chilly. Let's get back to Eric and Ben to hear how they finally pulled him out.
On the second attempt going up the line that they dropped in, anyway, I was getting really cold. I'd been in there for 30 or 40 minutes by that time, and I was losing so much dexterity. I think I made a loop with a knot the first time. And then the second time I only had dexterity to take the carabiner, put it under my armpit, and then clip it to the other side of the rope. So when I was going up, it was quite a squeeze. I don't think I could have gotten out if I wanted to. I mean, you would have to have pulled up on the rope to loosen it to get out. So, and I felt like I was probably going to be close to passing out on the line just from the squeeze and the amount of minutes that I had already been on it. When that pause came again and they were starting to reset it, Ben got close to the edge and he looked over and, I didn't hold back. You know, I told him, yeah, I think I yelled, I was like, Ben, help. You know, and I yelled a couple of times. I was like, help, help. Like, we have to get this, we have to get up this last 10 or 15 feet, or else I think this is it. Like, I'm probably going to die down in this cave.
And at that point, I looked over the edge and I could see that Eric was like, it looked grim. You know, he looked freezing. I could see that he was shivering. And, you know, it was like a pretty desperate scene. So we, at that point, as the person reset the anchor, we just started hand over handing the rope up. We had a bunch of people and, you know, kind of to get him out of there as soon as possible and try to get him back to, you know, being warm and comfortable.
I think I came up over the edge and I told all those guys straight up, thank you so much. You very much just saved my life.
Eric's day on the water was done at this point, and he decided to walk out due to the physical toll the cold immersion had taken. He made a full recovery. Eric and Ben described their perspectives on lessons learned from this rescue.
So the two biggest takeaways in my mind are, don't abbreviate your scouting on, you know, on game day or when you're there looking at a big drop. You watch a lot of content of these big complex drops, especially if they're not running all the time or they're not like your local drops. So, you know, you might be traveling far distance to get to them. You still can't really cut those corners. I think it's important to maybe approach those drops as if you've never seen them before and try to look at them from all the different angles and still take that time. You know, I abbreviated the scouting process because of all the other research I did, even though I knew when I was scouting and I looked at it from angles that I really hadn't looked at it that closely before. And was noticing that flow, it seemed different. It was just pushing towards the cave a lot harder than I thought. So I would look from the river left, from the river right at the top of the drop. I never even really looped around to the other side of the cliff above the cave, which looks straight back at the waterfall. I'd want to take a look, you know, a long look from that angle. I'd like to scamper down the cliff on the right side and look from that side as well, you know, really take some more time to look at it from all the angles. But, you know, still don't abbreviate that scouting process on game day. And then don't abbreviate your safety plan. You know, if you are checking the boxes for all of the contingencies and possible outcomes, I'm a big believer of redundancy. I like redundancy, you know, having more than one safety mechanism, you know, whatever that is. I had a safety plan for the cave, but it would have been more than okay, preferable to have a couple of safety plans for the cave, to have that ascender kit already dropped in there with a harness and ascenders down into that cave.
One of my takeaway from this incident is like, being prepared for the worst case scenario. You know, sometimes it's hard, like in the moment, to think about the worst case scenario. Everyone's trying to, you know, kind of think about those things in a minimal way, trying to go big and, you know, visualizing positive outcomes, but just having that kind of hard conversation about like, what are we going to do if something does go wrong here, and being prepared for it. The crew that I was kayaking with, I'd kayaked with those people a lot. I'd done the Royal Gorge with a handful of those people before. We'd had that conversation about like, what is the worst case scenario here? We'd had that conversation even before that day. And, you know, we were prepared for pretty much anything that could happen there. I've been involved in a handful of rescues there. Several like real quick rescues, like lost paddle, broken paddle, the person on river right throws someone a paddle, or at least like throws that person a rope and kind of pull them up out of the river so they can get a paddle back in their hand. And then I've been involved in a couple of vertical extractions out of the cave. You know, the other thing I would say is like, you know, we were fortunate. We had a big crew with lots of experience. Carson Lindsay was the person that built the anchor. And not only does he know how to build an anchor, he can do it super fast and efficiently. And he didn't have to be in charge of the rescue at the same time. You know, we had a whole nother crew. He was just focused on what he was doing. And just, you know, having leadership in something as simple as counting to three and pulling, you know, and 1, 2, 3, pull, 1, 2, 3, pull, you know, keeping it efficient and organized and, you know, having one person lead that effort is definitely key there, you know, because, you know, with the fewer people, if you only had three people pulling, you're going to get to a place where you're going to start to fatigue. And if someone's not counting, people are going to stop pulling hard at the same time. And it just, you lose the efficiency of the whole thing. The rocks there are really sharp. And there was actually a rescue years ago where someone was being vertically extracted. They were just hand over handing back away from the cliff, and the rope actually, you know, the sharpness of the rocks there actually wore through the rope, and the rope broke and the guy went back in the water. You know, that is an issue there. And it's fairly easily overcome. You just have to like look at exactly where you are. If you go too far back towards river right, it's just kind of like a knife edge right there. But if you go a little bit further to the left and downstream just a little bit, you can, there's like a softer gully that the rope sits in instead of just on the rocks. You know, one other thing that's kind of worth noting is that if you didn't get vertically extracted out of that place and you tried to swim downstream through the notch over that next 15-foot waterfall, it's not necessarily a better situation. The river right side there is very undercut, and it might even be harder to get to than the cave on river left below the waterfall. But it is like, you know, everyone that swims down there thinks like, you know, what if I have to swim? What am I going to do? Because it's like nearly impossible to swim to the river right side without getting swept over that 15-foot drop. But it doesn't necessarily make your situation any better. At lower water, you could lower someone a boat. You could maybe even self-rescue. If your boat was there's a ledge that you could stand on when the water's low and it's like a little bit calmer back there. But at those flows, it's like I said, it's like the water is like moving around, swirling pretty good. It'd be hard to do anything except vertically extract someone.
Before we wrap up, I think it's worth talking about some other issues related to cold water immersion. A lot of this information can be found on a website called Cold Water Safety, spearheaded by sea kayaker and physiologist Milton Avery. One of the interesting things it discusses is the cold water shock syndrome. This is an involuntary gasping and hyperventilation reflex that can happen when you are suddenly immersed in cool water. It also causes a steep rise in heart rate and blood pressure and can last several minutes. This cold water shock is probably responsible for many otherwise unexplained drownings, particularly of unacclimatized people exposed to sudden immersion. Surprisingly, the maximal effect of this is in water in the 50 to 60 degree range, which we commonly encounter on the river. The response can be blunted by habitual exposure and by protective clothing. We already discussed the second phase of cold water immersion injury, which is incapacitation, which can occur within just a few minutes. This can lead to swimming failure and drowning as you lose motor control. The third phase is true hypothermia, occurring after very prolonged immersion, usually taking over 30 minutes to occur even in very cold water. This is defined as a core body temperature of less than 95 degrees. Once you get into this phase, things are really dicey. The victim may be confused or unconscious and at risk for cardiac arrhythmias and sudden death. They will likely be totally non-functional in terms of helping themselves out of the situation. And in some cases, a sudden physiologic collapse can occur as they are removed from the water. In all of these issues, once the victim is out of the water, rewarming measures should be started. This involves removal of wet clothing, adding warm dry layers, warm compresses, and warm non-alcoholic drinks. If they are capable of moving and feeding, they should do so to help generate body heat. Sometimes a raging fire or skin-to-skin contact with a warm body are needed to help rewarm as well. The Cold Water Safety website explains a lot of the science and details behind all of this and more. It's a great free resource and worth a few minutes of your time to check it out. Among the many other amazing things happening that day on the Royal Gorge, once Dane did his reverse freewheel off this Heath 2 waterfall, he then purposely paddled back into the cave to help retrieve some of Eric's gear. It's a pretty sketchy scene to watch. I've included links to these videos on our Facebook site. You can see Eric's line off of the drop, his initial moments in the cave, and then you can see Dane's video of part of the rescue and his efforts to clean up the gear at the end. It also shows his amazing freestyle moves off of Scott's drop and some of the other rapids. Eric also has a lot of videos online that you can see on his YouTube site, mostly involving his wild descents in the southeast. Spring paddling season is upon us, and things should start heating up soon. Hope to see you on the river.
Thank you for listening to The Safety Break, the Whitewater Rescue Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, hit the subscribe button and click follow on our Facebook page so that we know that you're out there. I'm also looking for more stories. If you know of an interesting non-fatal river accident or rescue, send me a few details by email, safetybreak@gmail.com. It doesn't have to be dramatic or life-threatening, just something that we all might be able to learn from. I'll see if we can turn it into an episode. Stay safe out there, and I hope to see you on the river.